Dan Matthews and Max Frater.
Hello and welcome to Lacrosse Talk, everybody. I'm Dan Matthews with co-host Max Frater, and this is Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport. And Max, it's a glorious day. It's Super Bowl Sunday, and lacrosse season is starting to get underway, and we are moving platforms. We are now on the Laxworm Radio Experience each and every week, the Laxworm Radio Experience being the first 24/7 lacrosse talk platform in the world.
And Dan, you had the chance to be out at LaxCon in Baltimore last weekend with Laxworm and the Maryland Lax Insiders and a couple of the other guys who are going to be helping compile all this material for the Laxworm Radio Experience. I only heard what it was like over the phone, had a chance to talk to a couple of guys that you that had pulled over to the booth that you were at, but what was it like sitting at lacrosse at LaxCon, being able to see the draft and just being able to see the experience?
The LaxCon experience is always a good one. There's good crowds. There's a lot of good information. I've said for a long time, yeah, I've gone out there now for 3 out of the last 5 years, and I have yet to be able to see any of the speakers actually speak. And I'm looking forward to the time where I don't have to work the booth the whole time or work for what we're doing, and to be able to hear the speakers, guys like John Donowski and Kevin Cassis and Dave Huntley and Randy Murrins, who we had on with us at the end of the experience last week. And these guys are the best in the business, and they really shed a lot of light and insight on what they do. I know that our first guest has had opportunity to sit in on some of those lectures and have other extensive conversations with them, and maybe we can dive into that for just a minute with him. But the experience as a whole really is fantastic.
I mean, the coolest thing that I saw about it, and I was still here in Denver, so I was looking from afar and kind of see how everybody else was covering it, but just the fact that the lacrosse players and coaches around there were celebrities. I mean, those guys could not walk 5-10 paces without someone coming up and saying, "Hey, can I get a picture with you? Can you autograph this? Hey, can you jump on the show, answer a couple questions for me?" You know, so it's just really cool because, I mean, in the lacrosse world, these guys are big-time names and people that we want to talk to, sit down with, but you don't always get the chance to. And the majority of people who follow lacrosse, they know these guys, but to be able to get right in front of them in a place like the Baltimore Convention Center, I thought it looked great. I mean, I want to go next year, absolutely, but just being able to look from the outside in, it was cool.
Well, and at the same time, it's interesting because these guys, many of them would be in booths working. For example, Drew Adams was right across the walkway from us, and I don't think half the people that talked to him really knew who he was. He was there representing Cascade Maverick, and I think that at times they and he can kind of walk in anonymity, if you will.
Which should not be happening. I mean, especially
a player like
Drew Adams, that's a crime to me. But still, the fact that he was there, you had guys like Rabel, you had guys like Harrison. I know that Peter Baum was there, Jeremy Sieverts, we had a chance to talk to, Liam Banks, Brendan Mundorf. So a ton of big names, and for them to be able to kind of showcase everything that they've gotten and reach out to the kids. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what LaxCon's all about, right? It's just to get everybody pumped up, ready for the season to go. So it looked like it was a great turnout. By the numbers, it was the best turnout that LaxCon has ever had. So I'm a little jealous of you, Dan. I'm not going to lie, especially since you were launching the Laxworm Radio Experience, and you got to be the first one to host a show on there. That's very cool. But we'll have a lot more chances to go at it from this weekend on to get a show on LRE.
Absolutely. Not a doubt about it. Without any further ado, let's bring in our first and one of our favorite guests, Mr. Terry Foy, Editor-in-Chief at Inside Lacrosse Magazine. And Terry is here to wrap up our NCAA Division I preview. Terry, thanks for being here.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me. It's appropriate timing given the fact that in about 3 hours, the first lacrosse game of the 2015 season, Division One wise at least, will be completed.
Exactly, without a doubt. Terry, we're talking MAC and NEC and a host of others this week with Patriot and Southern, and we got an independent or two to talk about as well. Let's jump right into it and talk a little bit about the MAC. For a long time, this really has been Siena's conference to win or lose.
Sure, yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, certainly the transition from Brecht to Zvek and the smoothness with which that's gone, you know, not seeing the Saints not step off or fall off dramatically throughout that is a testament to the way in which, you know, the staff has gone about building a program. And I think that that's one of the things that has been an organizational, institutional challenge for a lot of MAC teams, is that they haven't been supplied with the resources to focus on building a program. So instead, you know, they have to focus on building a team more so on a year-to-year basis. And as a result, I think it's one of the reasons that you see a lot of turnover and a lot of fluctuation and a lot of interesting games, particularly in the conference tournament. I think that the MAC conference tournament is always either the most or the second most interesting conference tournament over the course of the college lacrosse season, because the teams are relatively evenly matched and there's a lot of opportunity for a team to get hot. No better example than Detroit. In 2013, when they were able to win their last two games of the regular season in order to qualify, win both conference tournament games, and then put a scare into Notre Dame in their first-round NCAA tournament game.
Terry, always a pleasure to talk with you, sir. I hope that you're staying warm and dry. The blizzard over on the East Coast looks pretty miserable. We got a taste of it actually this morning here in Denver. I think we picked up about 4 inches of snow. So I can feel a little bit of your pain, but I hope everything's going well over there for you. My first question to you is, like you said, Detroit Mercy and Siena are the two teams going back and forth in the MAC, whether who wins the conference or who tries to pull the upset off in the tournament. But here in the face-off yearbook, you have Marist tied for second with Detroit in the conference standings. What do the Red Foxes have coming into this season that makes them look like a contender against Siena?
Yeah, they have a senior-laden group, particularly in terms of their roster construction, top to bottom. And I also think that in J.D. Raycor, they have a guy who was among the best freshmen offensively last year. And to me, for a freshman to come in and contribute at that level, in this conference, speaks to having the type of player that can carry your team year to year in a way that is very special and very, you know, kind of significant in the league. So, you know, I compare him to somebody like Tim Edwards, who doesn't necessarily put up the 45-point seasons, but that's largely because he's a midfielder who faces off and oftentimes faces off at above 60 to 65% rate. But he has been a contributor at Canisius since arriving on campus. And, you know, a guy like Tim Edwards being a senior is one of those elements that in this league can be the thing that pushes Canisius over the hump. So despite the fact that they're picked fourth in the preseason coaches poll, at least according to Faceoff Yearbook, to me doesn't disqualify them in any measure from being able to put a serious run into a conference championship in an NCAA AQ.
Terry, when we kick off our live play-by-play coverage, we're going to get a good look at Canisius. They'll be here in Denver, and they'll be taking on Furman and Air Force. What will we get to look forward to when we look at Tim Edwards and the Canisius Griffins?
With Tim Edwards, he probably has the strongest claim for being the throwbackiest midi in Division One, because he plays a lot of defense, he faces off, and he plays a good portion of their offensive run. I got an opportunity to speak to Coach Marins last weekend, and I think that, you know, my sense from his team, or the way he talks about his team, is that the infusion of their freshman and sophomore class, as well as the retention among their junior and senior class, has created a uniquely deep team for him. So, you know, I would expect that whether, you know, it's guys like Vince Gravino and Austin Romantic taking on bigger steps or bigger roles this year, or Jeff Edwards, Tim Edwards' little brother, you know, taking on a bigger role offensively after coming off a 20-point season as a midi last year. You know, those are the things that that you can kind of look to be the baseline for this team.
So, Terry, one of the big themes that comes to the MAC is the senior leadership or the experience on all of these rosters. I mean, just taking a look at the all-conference preseason selections, as you mentioned in the face-off yearbook, 10 of the 12 guys are seniors between Siena, Detroit, Canisius, Quinnipiac. So out of all the other years where the MAC has made the tournament and, you know, at least had the potential to pull the upset, as you mentioned, with Detroit Mercy, given Notre Dame a scare a couple years ago, do you feel like this year is the best opportunity for the MAC to make a statement in the NCAA tournament?
Well, I know that it's a big part of the conversation that those coaches have among themselves over the course of the year is that, or over the course of, you know, a couple of seasons, it's that, you know, you're able to see, like, you know, you kind of mentioned Bryant winning an NCAA tournament game last year and what that does for the profile of a league like the NEC. You know, the NEC's approach heading into this season is the winner of our league should find or needs to find a way to avoid the play-in game. You know, I think for the MAC, which is a much more established conference within NCAA D1 lacrosse, there's still that goal of we need to win an NCAA tournament game. And the thing about the rising tide raises all boats element of what's happened in the MAC over the last 5 years is that while that's true, I'm not certain that it has been to the benefit of one singular team such that when that team qualifies for the NCAA tournament, they're in a better position to win a game than they were 5 years ago. Because while you compare that to the NEC and Bryant, who has made serious strides in terms of, you know, kind of formalizing the program to the level of a lot of top 10, top 20 teams, and as a result, it's less of a – it's an easier thing to imagine them winning a first-round tournament game. Yeah, that hasn't necessarily been the case for any single MAC program. So even though the competition within the conference is better and the aggregate wins over top 30, top 40 programs that MAC teams are able to accumulate in a year is higher, it hasn't necessarily translated into a higher likelihood of being able to beat a top 10 team.
Terry, you mentioned Bryant and the NEC. Later on today we're going to have Taylor Ray on, head coach from St. Joe's. You look at St. Joe's, and you firmly believe that they may be the sleeper team in the country this year. Talk a little bit about the Hawks.
I mean, they just have a lot of talent. They have a lot of guys that are bona fide players, and I think that that's a really obvious starting point. But at the same time, it's one that I think you can relatively easily overlook, particularly for a program that doesn't get, you know, tons of recognition, whether it be, you know, games against ACC-level opponents that get large attendance numbers, games that get on TV, or, you know, the types of matchups that make you circle them on the calendar to say, I'm going to figure out a way to watch that game online. So, you know, I think that in Restivo they have a player who is kind of like, I don't want to compare him to Raycor because, you know, I'm not familiar enough with each of their games in order to know for sure that that's a fair comparison. But a player who, as a freshman last year, immediately stepped in and produced and an enormous kind of element of what you can do, particularly, then this is the difference between a program like, or a team like St. Joe's versus a team like Marist, where he's in a complementary role. You know, it's Ryan McGee, the senior offensive player, who I think there are expectations he's going to be the guy that can kind of control things. He's the guy that is the straw that stirs the drink, so to speak. And when you see these types of teams come together with these types of runs, it's reminiscent to me of what we saw from Lafayette. I can't remember if it was in 2010 or 2011, but when they cracked the top 10, beat Navy at home early in the season, had a couple of those types of wins. You know, it was a couple of really kind of cornerstone foundational players. Steve Sterling was the player for Lafayette, but then it was, you know, five or six complementary offensive players that made it so that opponents couldn't game plan for one particular guy. And I think that's what St. Joe's has been able to build at the offensive end. And then at the defensive end, you know, they have a goaltending that can be above 55%, which is a really important thing for, you know, a defense that wants to play the way Taylor likes to make his defenses play. It's really, I mean, having a goalie above 55% is important for any defense, obviously, but in particular because, you know, Taylor being a defensive coach, I think he does two things, and I hope he can speak to this a little bit better, when you get to have him on. But, you know, I think he likes to be multiple in his looks, meaning that, you know, put a lot of pressure on his personnel to know what to do and also be relatively aggressive. And they were able to be really impressive in terms of a defensive efficiency rate, and it was one of the things that, you know, was the reason that they had a 11-4 season last year.
Terry, Coach Ray has been with St. Joe's now. This will be his fourth season. He played for Bryant's head coach, Mike Pressler, at Duke. What has he picked up from Coach Pressler, and how does he translate it on the field as far as what you've seen so far?
Well, I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to speak to exactly what has been passed down from an organizational perspective, but I will say that, you know, when you watch the teams play, I think it's funny because when I think of the 2005 Duke team, which you can make an argument for, or 2005 and 2006 primarily, before the scandal occurred, you can make an argument that those were, you know, two of the most talented teams in recent memory in terms of the number of guys who were just top-notch players at so many positions. And the way in which they were able to overwhelm opponents was a really, like, significant thing, and it was because they were able to get defensively, push the ball in transition, and then if they weren't going to score, they were so lethal in 6-on-6. I mean, it's just having all facets of the game covered. And I think that it's difficult to when you look at the numbers and you try to parse them out, it's difficult to say, okay, this team plays fast when they don't have a really high number of possessions in their game. It's like the easiest way to say this team plays fast. The ball goes from one end of the field to the other a lot. But I think that what it is with the style that Pressler has developed and carried over to Bryant is they get stops at a really high rate. So, you know, his defensive efficiency has been top 10 each of the last four seasons. They get a lot of production offensively out of their defensive midfielders. So Cody O'Donnell was a freshman long stick for Bryant last year who had 14 points. If they don't score in transition, they aren't necessarily deliberate offensively, but they aren't reckless. They don't take a lot of chances the way that some relatively highly efficient offenses like Albany or Denver do, where you see risky passes that go out of bounds, and it leads to a game that has more the ball moving from one end of the field to the other. So that was a convoluted way of saying that I think more than anything else, the thing that Taylor has taken from his experience with Pressler and also from his playing experience is getting stops is how you start to win games. And because that's kind of what you saw out of St. Joe's last year is that defensive efficiency being a big part of their improvement year over year.
So Coach Ray and the Hawks obviously have a lot of momentum going into 2015 after finishing up the season the way they did. But at the end of the day, they still have a major hurdle to cross over, and that's going to be the Bryant Bulldogs. And they came on my radar two seasons ago when they went into the Carrier Dome and gave Syracuse a fantastic game. And then last year going in and finishing the job, watching the performance by Gunnar Waltz, I think that was one of the better keeper performances I've seen in many years. And they return him, they return a lot of their defensive starters, and then two of their big offensive guys in Tucker James Tucker James, their starting attackman. But are they poised to make that kind of same run this year in 2015 as they did last year?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bryant's holes are in the midfield where they have to replace, two of their top three offensive midfielders and a couple of their short 60 middies as well. But, you know, they've got a spine and they've got bookends at each end of the field that they can build off of. So, you know, I think from a talent perspective, there's reason to expect year-over-year gain. I think from the magic of being able to be, you know, a top three seed, that's something that you can't predict at this stage in the season, right? So I think that they will be in position to do that, but whether or not they'll actually be able to pull it off is something that you're not going to know until the middle of the third quarter when you start to get that sense of, oh, my God, the underdog might do it. You know, it's not unfathomable that Bryant's going to, I'm trying to think of what type of record they'd have to put together. I mean, they definitely have to start 5 or 6-0 because that's where the strength of their schedule lies. I'm talking about the path to getting a home game and being favored in the first round. They might have to very nearly run the table in order to do that. So it's likely that they're going to be on the road in the first round and be an underdog. And do they have the tools to pull an upset? Absolutely. You know, will they be able to? Well, I can tell you that in a much clearer way almost exactly 3 months from now.
Terry, real quick on these two conferences, the MAC and the NEC, they seem very top-heavy. How far away are these conferences from having a little bit more parity within them, top to bottom?
I wouldn't say that the MAC is super top-heavy. I think that, you know, the top four or five programs each have a relatively equitable shot at winning a championship. You know, I would say that Monmouth has a second-year program who didn't win a game in their first season. I saw Monmouth play two or three times last year. Saw them against UMBC, watched them online against Wagner, and I believe I saw a third game as well. They have pieces in place that it wouldn't, you know, I think that they're going to win a game or two. And again, like, that's the beauty of these leagues. It's the beauty, but it's also the curse. Like, you win two games at the end of the season, and if they're against the right two opponents, you're in the conference tournament. And if that's the case, we talked about this a couple weeks ago with the Big Ten, and you know, it not being outside of the realm of possibility that Michigan or Rutgers could sneak their way into the Big Ten tournament. You know, you win two games in mid to late April, and all of a sudden your season gets extended by an additional week, and what could have previously been described as a failure is immediately described as a success because probably isn't a part of Monmouth's reasonable expectations to qualify for the conference tournament right now. So, you know, I see some parity there already. With the NEC, you know, Hobart's arrival in the league was one that was going to be an interesting development as it relates to, is this the right fit for Hobart in Division I lacrosse finally? Because despite the fact that they were able to win some ECAC games against some really good teams, it was that level of consistency that they weren't able to attain. And it seemed like that was going to be a common issue in the NEC, kind of in the same way that it was the MAC, as I kind of referred to at the beginning of the conversation. You know, but when you look at Mount St. Mary and Robert Morris, two teams that have been either in or on the cusp of the NCAA tournament in the not-too-distant past, you know, I expect them both to press the reset button and make significant gains, if not in 2015, then in 2016 and 17, because I you've seen clear paths or clear models of success at both of those programs. You know, Mount St. Mary's is always going to be struggling in the wake of the 2013 season when they pushed all of their chips into the middle of the table as it related to having so many seniors and so few non-seniors contribute that they were going to take a step back that was probably going to last more than one season anyway. So, you know, I would say that I thought we start to see the seeds of the lower level, you know, the fourth, fifth, sixth place teams in the NEC challenging Bryant and St. Joe's in a more significant way this year. But I think that in the NEC, you're going to start to see that bear fruit in a more real way next year.
Terry, let's move over to the Patriot League, and that is a league that definitely has a lot of parity. You see Loyola, who ran the table in the conference last year, picked to win it again. But below them, you've got four very credible competitive teams in Army, Lehigh, Bucknell, and Colgate. What can we expect to see from these guys who are trying to catch Loyola right now?
First of all, the makeup and shakeup of the Patriot League is one that's going to be 3 to 4 years in development because you've got a new program in BU that everybody understands how they're resourced and their geographic advantages and interested to see what they end up becoming as they grow to maturity. And you also have a Loyola program that, you know, had one identity for about 25 years, and now because of the academic restrictions levels of the Patriot League, it's interesting to see how that changes what Loyola is going forward, and they're only in year two of that, so it's kind of an experiment that's still playing out. But then, you know, within those two bookends and you know, kind of the new infusion that they brought to the league, you've got six or seven teams with kind of this long-standing dynamic of kind of a very, like, cyclical development that is once Navy kind of relinquished its stranglehold on the league in the mid-2000s to the point where, you know, Bucknell, Colgate, Lehigh, and Army have all had their kind of shot at the crown. You know, and I even referenced Lafayette's, you know, really kind of lightning in a bottle type season at the beginning part of this decade. So it's a long and convoluted way of saying that I don't know how good B is going to become, to the degree that you could imagine them being a bona fide year-over-year contender for the Patriot League, you know, starting in 5 years and moving forward. Nor do I know exactly how much Loyola as a dominant program in the Patriot League is going to fall back to the pack because of what the Patriot League is going to do to their ability to, you know, accept qualifiers that maybe other programs in the league can't, or accept transfers, or some of the things that have been very important to their why Loyola has been so good over the last roughly decade. All of that being said, there are five programs who care about lacrosse just below that level, and they're all chasing Loyola. So they're going to figure out their own things that they can do to improve in general, especially in a way that they're kind of doing the same thing, which is we got to figure out ways to win tournament games once we arrive in a consistent way, because Lehigh, for example, you know, is still chasing that ring, even though they, because of their consistency in the top 15, seem like a program that has attained a lot more success than they actually have.
Terry, when we look at the Patriot League, earlier this week, Coach Rick Soule at Navy was quoted as saying that he believes his team can contend for this title. How far away do you believe that Navy is from being able to contend for this title?
Well, McNear, the managing editor at IL, has kind of had his finger on the pulse of Navy for a while. And, you know, he's seen that he saw them practice in the fall. He went to their scrimmage last weekend. And his attitude towards what Navy can be this year offensively is, how good can freshman attackman Jack Ray be? Because he is a physically overwhelming presence who didn't play in their scrimmage against Richmond, who, as a result of his absence, according to Matt, kind of was either allowed or the cause of the midfield to sink back into its, or the offense in general, but the midfield in particular, dodging kind of to nowhere, moving the ball around the perimeter with not a lot of opportunities being created. Whereas when Ray, a 6'5", 230-plus pound guy, is bowling to the cage and defenses are collapsing on him, there are just so many opportunities for skip passes, step-down looks, and as a result, the offense just clicks at a much higher rate. And I think that if you can see that developing from a physical edge standpoint, which I think has been one of the areas in which Navy has lacked over the last couple of seasons, then you can start seeing those close losses turn into close wins. And to me, you know, when I look at Navy, particularly given the fact that I expect them to be very good again at the faceoff act with Brady Dell coming back, you know, I think that they're going to be a program that not only outplays their preseason ranking, which I believe was 54 in faceoff yearbook, but, you know, again, it's all about winning a couple of key games and being in the mix. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they finished fifth or sixth in the Patriot League, qualified for the Patriot League tournament, and then won their quarterfinal game, and all of a sudden they were in the semis against a Loyola or, you know, a Lehigh or a Army, with an opportunity to win that game and go to the Patriot League championship and play for an AQ.
So, Terry, looking specifically at Army, they've had a pretty solid tradition of outstanding attackmen coming out of West Point, where you're looking at Jeremy Boltis and Garrett Duell, who have also gone on to perform very well in the pros. John Glessner was drafted in the first round to the Cannons. Do you think that he carries on that tradition of outstanding attackmen and finishes it off this season at Army?
I do, but I also think that he brings in a little bit of an additional element because of the fact that, you know, he can play midfield as well. He has played midfield and attack both in high school and in college, and that versatility, particularly his ability to dodge from two or three different angles on the field, is one of the things that makes him a little bit different from, you know, Jeremy, who was a very traditional ex-attackman, or Garrett, who, you know, was a heavy shooting wing attackman in college that, interestingly, in his role with the U.S. national team, started running out of the box a little bit more. You know, I think that we saw the best and worst of John Glessner in Army's regular season matchup versus Loyola, in which I believe it was awesome. It was one of those – I think he took 17 shots. I think he scored once. And it was one of those things where he was just matched up against Joe Fletcher, a high school teammate and classmate of his, and Fletcher was just following him all over the field. And the amount of times that Glessner went down the ready alley and Fletcher was just in his hands in a really exceptional way and, you know, shot one over the crossbar or got stopped and went the other way, it demonstrated the fact that, you know, here's a guy who isn't scared to be the epicenter of his team's offense and certainly is willing to shoot, knows how to get separation, but ultimately just wasn't quite at the level to be able to beat who the guy who, in my opinion, was the nation's best defenseman last year on a regular basis and you know, be able to turn a one goal on 17 shot day into a 3 or 4 goal on 12 or 13 shot day, which is obviously a much higher success rate. So, you know, I think that in this year, what you expect to see, you know, he was so physically developed, I don't think that that's going to be the area in which his game takes a significant jump. I think that it's kind of the burden of pressure that the rest of Army's offense, you know, because they've returned so much, brings to opposing defenses need to game plan for 6 guys as opposed to 1. I think that is where you're going to see the biggest gain in Glessner's productivity. And I also think that, you know, it's going to be one of those things where if there is any, out of all of the, you know, top 20 teams, it's hard for me to imagine another program having a guy that, you know, in a tie game or down 1 coming out of a timeout with 30 seconds to go, everybody is more certain that one particular guy is going to be the guy, if not taking the shot, then having the ball in a stick, at least making the decision about who is going to take the shot. So, you know, to answer your question, which to make a long story longer, yes, I think he is going to take a step forward in 2015, which will translate into, you know, being an even more sought-after pro by the time he hits the field for the Cannons than he is even right now.
You're listening to Lacrosse Talk with Dan Matthews and Max Frater. Our guest is Terry Foy on the Lax Worm Radio Experience. Terry, Lehigh took a huge hit this week. How much impact will this have on that squad and their chances for postseason play this year?
It's such a bummer. I mean, it's hard to. First of all, you know, they're out. They're suspended indefinitely, and it's unclear when those 3 players are going to be able to return to the program. You know, I think that the other one that was an additional hit that I think went a little bit less noticed was Dylan O'Shaughnessy, a big long stick midfielder who was really fun to watch, wasn't with the team in the fall, and it was confirmed that he won't be with the team again in the spring, not related to the incident that led to the suspension of Corbett Eaton and the defenseman whose name escapes me at the moment. Telesco. You know, the length of that suspension obviously is going to have a really significant impact on, you know, particularly Lehigh's capacity for winning some early season games. I believe they play Loyola on February 28th, which is, you know, obviously a big early season game for them. But that being said, if they're able to return at the end of the season, and particularly if the Mountain Hawks as a squad are able to rally around this as a setback, as a piece of adversity that needs to be overcome, and it's one of those things where the guys who step up in place of 3 starters on each unit end up being benefiting from the additional experience, and then those guys are able to return, you know, you could imagine it being a net gain by the end of the season, which would be obviously the best silver lining you could put on an otherwise rough situation. But there's no question that, you know, you remove probably your second best player from each unit, it's gonna hurt you. And so, you know, at the very least, it wasn't Dan Taylor and Curtis Connes and Matt Poyon, because that would probably hurt a little bit worse. But it's going to be something that, you know, Lehigh has been recruiting pretty well over the last 3 years, and their strategy has changed over the last year to 2 years in contrast to the first 3 or 4 that Kevin was on campus. So now it's a matter of testing that test a little bit earlier than you otherwise would have liked if you were a Lehigh coach and seeing how it comes to fruition. It's really difficult. I'm sure that they don't even know what type of team they're going to look like when they hit the field, in contrast to how firm their expectations were, you know, just last Saturday.
Terry, I want to move on to the final conference we're going to be talking about, and that's the Southern Conference. When I look at the breakdown of the teams that are in here, and Bellarmine just jumping in, they're sitting at 3rd in the preseason coaches poll. To me, that's a little bit of a low standard for them, because the SoCon teams that they played last year, they beat all of them. And I think that Bellarmine, the way that their record usually pulls out is because of the level of competition, them playing in the ECAC, they're not quite up to par with those teams. But do you feel like these rankings could change pretty quickly as soon as Bellarmine hits the field against an entirely Southern Conference schedule?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the ECAC is going to be relatively close facsimile to the Southern Conference in terms of how much they're going to travel. So I don't expect that to be a huge issue. You know, they had to go to Air Force. They had to go to Hobart. These aren't places that are incredibly close to Louisville, Kentucky. So, you know, having to go to Mercer and having to go to Jacksonville probably isn't going to be too big of an ask on a year-over-year type basis. That being said, you're right. They performed well against those programs, but again, you know, this is a league where what you see in the regular season wasn't what you saw in the conference tournament. So, you know, are you going to base your preseason prognostication on what you expect the final conference standings to be, or are you going to in the conference tournament seedings, or are you going to base it on what you expect to see happen over the last weekend of April? And so, yeah, I see where you're coming from. I mean, I think that there's also it's important to take into consideration they did graduate a fair amount, you know, particularly in Mitchell and Gardner from the midfield. So they've got Seesaw and Shanks coming back as they were freshman attacking last year, have put together 60 points combined. So it's nice to have that building block out of your sophomore class, particularly from your group down low. But you don't know what you're going to get out of the midfield, and particularly Mitchell, who was such a unique matchup because he was so big. As a Dodger, I know that he was somebody that opposing ECAC coaches really kind of focused on when they prepared for him. The loss of Brechtman to a torn ACL, which was something we found out prior to the MLL draft last week, is another one of those transitional components because, you know, I only saw Bellarmine play, I think, twice last year, and they were both online, and I didn't feel like I came away with, like, a super good sense of what type of the team they were. You know, in contrast to particularly 2 years ago when I watched them a few more times, I really wanted to see, you know, how Dylan Ward was being able to be above 70% over the course of the season. You know, I thought that who they are heading into this year is a little bit more of a mystery to me. So, you know, the thing that you can kind of count on from some of these Southern Conference teams that you can't count on as much from a Bellarmine team is the aggregate growth of going from year one of your program to year two in Richmond's case, or 2 to 3 in the case of a High Point or you know, a couple other squads. Well, no, I guess they would be the only one. Marquette is obviously the other, but you know, Furman and even you know, Jacksonville and Mercer, these are less established programs than Bellarmine. So, you know, there's a reason to expect them, their growth curve to be more accelerated than Bellarmine's, whose, you know, kind of habits and patterns and situations and all the like are a little bit more established. You know, that's kind of where I see there being a little bit more of an argument to be made that let's take a wait-and-see approach with how good Bellarmine is going to be and not overreact to what they were able to do against these conference teams last year.
Terry, what's the dynamic at VMI that they are consistently a bottom feeder and have had such a struggle to build a program there?
I don't know. I don't know much about VMI as a program. It's, you know, it's a team that I've been able to see only a handful of times live over the course of my time at Inside the Cross. You know, I've gotten to know Brian Aiken a little bit, primarily through his role on the NCAA Championship Committee. And you've been able to see guys who have kind of emerged as star players at VMI go on to other aspects of their lacrosse careers and find success. You know, Steven Robards, the face-off guy who's put in some MLL face-off wins, being the most prominent example, but the attackman who transferred to Richmond in this offseason and was voted preseason all-conference being another example of that. You know, I think it's tough when there are certain aspects of what programs who have been unable to break through deal with that are in common, you know, and even though on a league-to-league type basis, the level of those might be different. So, you know, it's probably not fair to say that what Wagner deals with is exactly the same with what Holy Cross deals with, but at the same time, relative to the rest of their league teams, it might be fair to say that. You know, with VMI, it's probably a lack of, you know, funding as it relates to scholarships, probably just a difficult place to recruit from the aspect of the you know, service commitment on campus and the way in which that kind of infiltrates the rest of your program. And not only that, I also think that one of the things that is unique for VMI is that the experience that they offer is probably, you know, with the exception of the military component, it's probably relatively similar to the experience that a lot of the ODEC schools that are in the same region offer. So the fact that those ODEC schools so frequently are top 10, top 20 D3 programs, and, you know, VMI is so frequently a bottom 10 or a bottom 15 program at the D1 level, you know, it really is only the allure of D1 lacrosse that separates those two things. And you got a lot to overcome as it relates to arguably being able to compete for a national championship at a school like Lynchburg versus, you know, I guess at best hoping to break into the Southern Conference tournament, at least that being the standard right now at a program like VMI.
Terry, I want to take a look at Air Force, who is a resounding unanimous selection for first team All-Independent. They're kind of in limbo right now since the ECAC disbanded, and they're going to be joining the Southern Conference next year. But right now, taking a look at their schedule, they've got Duke to start the season off, and then they'll play Denver down the road. And those are the two toughest teams they'll have on the schedule all year. They'll play a couple of Southern Conference teams. They'll play some MAC, some NEC, kind of just a mix of every different conference here. But how do you approach this season if you're a player or a coach for Air Force saying, we only have two games to prove ourselves this year. If we win one of them, we have a chance of making the tournament.
That's a really good question. I think that there is a lot surrounding this program that makes it such that the internal motivation to succeed is far and away the most important thing. I think it's one of the reasons that there wasn't enough, for all that was made of how impressive it was for Air Force to come back and win the ECAC, qualify for a play-in game, beat Richmond, and then go to Duke for a first-round NCAA tournament game. For as much as was made of that, not enough was made of that, particularly given the fact that heading into the 2014 season, I was so optimistic for what Air Force was going to be able to be because it struck me that they had such the right mix of senior leadership, particularly at the offensive end, you know, and especially in a guy like Mike Crampton, but also rounded out by Tommy McKee, Eric Smith, Kyle Cassidy. I mean, they had four seniors and put up 40 points last year. I mean, it was like a lightning in a bottle type thing. But also, the thing that I thought was when you looked at their schedule, if they were able to catch Denver in their first game of the season, they had a legitimate shot at being 10-0. It so happened that not only did they lose to Denver, but they also lost to Canisius and VMI, which was probably the most head-scratching result of the year last year. The season really, you know, obviously stemming from a tragedy in the fall of 2013, including the existential threat to the program in the spring of 2014, and then stemming to the projection that they were going to struggle to find a conference home in 2015. There was so much about what was going to happen to that program last year that was just the only thing that you could have done, and this is why Eric Saramet was very deserving in winning the D1, the IMLCA's or USILA's D1 Coach of the Year award, was you pop up your chest, you steel yourself to all the external forces, you try to get better every day, and you just hope, particularly after year 2 and 3, that just stringing together a series of wins is enough to salvage your season, and I think it did. And I think that as a result, it makes 2015 a little bit easier because it shows what just putting your head down, doing your job, trying to attain incremental success, incremental victories does. You can't focus on the fact that you need to be perfect in order to qualify for an NCAA tournament bid. I think Penn State learned that lesson pretty early on in the season last year, and you saw them kind of limp to the finish line, so to speak, realizing that because they didn't have an opportunity to play in the CAA tournament, there was, you know, basically their role was to play spoiler and hope. If Air Force is looking at their season like, if we don't beat Duke, that's exactly what the rest of our year holds in the store, well, then that sucks. But I also think that there's value in realizing that it's a temporary thing. I think that it was very good to see that they were able to gain membership for 2016 in the Southern Conference prior to the start of the 2015 season, because then as a program, as a group, you're saying, all right, this is only a one-year thing, and then we're going to be able to have that second bite of the apple that pretty much 67 other programs in Division I lacrosse have fifth year. You know, it's not a good answer. It's not a good solution. But at the same time, a group of guys that you expect to be able to handle that, and a coaching staff that you expect to be able to handle that, it's a group of guys that have decided they wanted to go to a service academy in Colorado Springs, and a coaching staff that went through what they went through last year.
Terry, I want to back up to the very first conference we covered on our preseason previews, the ACC, and Virginia in particular, for just a moment. They've already lost Greg Danceglio to Maryland. Now Mick Parks is no longer on the roster. And this week, defenseman from Kent Denver here in Denver, Tanner Scales, injures himself. He's out for the season. How much more difficult has all of this made it for Virginia to have success in the ACC this year?
Yeah, we reported the Tanner Scales news this morning. It's obviously, you know, just really, really disappointing. I think that, you know, in talking to Dom a couple times over the course of the fall and winter, you know, they were under no apprehensions or misapprehensions that they were going to be young defensively, and that they were going to have to work some magic. You know, the Parks removal from the roster, and there is hope that he might be able to return in 2016, made it even more difficult because you can't rely then on the possession advantage to diminish the stress on your defense. So, you know, ultimately, I kind of, like I've said multiple times throughout this podcast, I want to take a wait-and-see approach with Virginia because, you know, there is so much talent latent on that roster that it could so happen that the guys that emerge are just, you know, not up to the level of the guys that they're replacing, and as a result, they're not going to be as good. And, you know, another 10-6, 9-8 type season might be in store for Virginia. But there's also the possibility that, you know, a guy like Carlson Milliken, who's going to take on a greater role as a sure six teammate, ends up being a total stud, a Will Hoss clone, who, you know, is a year-over-year gain at that position from what Virginia was offering last season, despite the fact that, you know, he wasn't there. Who knows what somebody like Will McNamara, who was a former number two recruit coming out of high school, is going to be able to bring to the table. And I think that there are a couple of other guys like that on this roster. And certainly, you know, Logan Greco and Scott Hooper are two freshmen, first years, that could do exactly the same thing. So, you know, my attitude is, Virginia is Virginia, and they've been through these fires before and won national championships. They've also put together a bona fide best team in the country, gone undefeated and won national championships. So it's just until all the eggs are cracked and, you know, scrambled and the season has turned into a disappointment for Virginia, I'm not willing to write them off in any capacity. I think that the road's going to be a little bit windier, and if they are successful, a little bit more impressive when they get to the bottom of it.
All right, Terry, one last question for you, and it's the most pressing question that all of us have on this Sunday afternoon. Who wins Super Bowl 49?
See, I'm interested in what this reception is going to be from what I assume are a pair of Broncos fans. Probably 65% of football fans think Seattle is going to win. I want Seattle to win. And I think that the reason I both think that I want them to win because I don't like my New England Patriots fan friends feeling good about themselves, I think that Seattle will win because I think that what they like to do defensively is what New England wants to do offensively. So I think that New England is going to struggle to move the ball incrementally, and as a result, they're going to have to resort to trying to move the ball in large chunks, and that's what they don't do well. And so I think that the reason that New England likes to move the ball incrementally is because they want to avoid the risk of making mistakes offensively. I don't think that they're going to be able to avoid that risk, and I think as a result, they're going to make a few mistakes. And so I think that that'll be the determining factor in the game. And if those things happen early, I wouldn't be stunned. I would be stunned to see Seattle put up like 50 or whatever they did to the Broncos last year, but I wouldn't be stunned to see it be a relatively non-competitive game if the Patriots turn the ball over twice in the first half and Seattle build a 17-0 lead.
Terry, as always, we appreciate it, and great insights on the rest of the NCAA Division I landscape.
thanks for having me. Sorry for dominating your show, fellas.
Hey, we love having you. You can dominate it anytime you want.
Thank you, Terry.
That's Terry Foy, our NCAA Division I insider, and great insight. I love talking to Terry because you can throw anything at Terry, and he has a response.
Well, he's got great insight on lacrosse and apparently the NFL, too. I mean, I wouldn't have that detailed of an answer when you ask me who I think is going to win the Super Bowl. I mostly go on exactly like he said. I don't want my New England Patriot friends to be happy about winning the Super Bowl, so I'm going to root for the other team. But, yeah, I mean, that was a ton of information. We covered four conferences, Air Force and the Independent, and then threw it back to the ACC, all pressing issues right now. And it's just the way that each conference has its own sort of identity. And it's cool to see from Terry's perspective, you see, with the MAC conference, it's a very senior-laden conference. They have a great opportunity to do something this year, and they have to move forward with it. Then you look at the NEC, very, very top-heavy. You got Bryant and St. Joe's. St. Joe's has the opportunity to upend Bryant and, be the surprise team of the year. So throughout this whole NCAA preview that we've done, we've kind of learned the identity of each conference, and you can see it play out throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, without a doubt. I know we don't want to let it slide without recognizing the passing of Jeremy Huber at Johns Hopkins, a major tragedy. Cause of death still unknown, and the Johns Hopkins family has our condolences here at Lacrosse Talk. Like Terry mentioned, the season about 9 minutes now from getting underway. By the time most people hear this on the Lax Worm Radio Experience, yes, we are tape delayed today because of the Super Bowl, everybody. That game will be over. But High Points at Delaware to open the 2015 NCAA Division I collegiate lacrosse season.
Let's get it on. I'm excited. I've been waiting ever since the ball dropped between Notre Dame and Duke in the championship last year for the next game to start up.
Yeah, an exciting season, and especially an exciting season around here with the University of Denver entering the season ranked number one. Let's make a jump now to the NCAA Division III ranks, where UMax had an opportunity to talk with our D3 insider, Jack Coyne, a little bit earlier this week.
Last time we had our guest on, Jack Coyne, we were looking at NCAA Division II and how things were going to shake out for this coming season. Now we're going to take a look at a much bigger field of play, and that's going to be Division III. And now we bring in our NCAA insider, Jack Coyne. Jack, how are you doing this morning?
Good, Max. How are you?
Good, thank you. Appreciate you joining me on Lacrosse Talk today. Let's start by looking at just the tournament structure, and we talked about it a little bit with NCAA Division II and how things shake out just by the placement of where the teams are. Coming in 2015, two more teams added to the field of play in the Division III tournament. It doesn't sound like that much of a big deal adding two teams, but it really kind of shakes things up. Kind of describe what the field of play is going to look like for the tournament this year.
Yep, they've added two automatic qualifiers, so there's 23 automatic qualifiers now, and they've restructured just because three big conferences came off of the Pool B books. They're now full NCAA conferences. The Southern Athletic Conference, which broke up from the SCAC, they're on it now, the MAC Freedom. So a bunch of teams, so the Pool B bids, which go to independents or leagues that don't have a NCAAQ yet, there's only three bids for them now. There was five last year, and those two other bids have flipped over. Actually, just one of them has flipped over to Pool C. So Pool C now has six bids. Pool C is the at-large pool for teams that their winner gets an AQ and the runner-up and other teams are eligible to get in the at-large pool. The independents are eligible for that pool as well, but they have never, ever really been in contention for them. So that it may gets us to the 32-team mark, which is kind of a watershed mark because this, if the tournament gets any bigger, it's going to cause discussions of how the tournament is going to fit because once you get past 32, you have to add another round of tournament games in. Right now it goes Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday, then the championship game a week later. So they'd have to add in another round there. So that may bring on sort of a regional aspect that the women kind of do now where, you know, you bring four teams to a local site and you play two games in a weekend, or some other option, maybe adding the Wednesday before the championship game, you add another round. So we'll see how that plays out. But, yeah, this is probably the last year just with the current growth of the sport. It'll probably go past 32 next year. So, yeah, this is sort of the last year things are kind of easy for the committee because it could get real complicated with the addition of another team.
And you mentioned regional games going on in the tournament, but when you think of the sport of lacrosse and regional, most of those regions end up on the East Coast. And with Division III, if lacrosse in general, the budgets aren't exactly that big for these teams to be able to travel across the country for multiple games. So when you're looking at teams that perennially make the tournament like Colorado College or an independent like Whittier who has to travel across the country to make these games happen, do you think the NCAA is going to try and formulate a way to make them have to travel less to make the tournament rather than have them play the team that they normally would in the tournament just based on the amount of travel they have?
Well, the committee is definitely aware of the geographical aspect of it, and it's one of the reasons why Cabrini, their tale of the last couple of years has been kind of tough because with the advent of a lot of teams in the upper Midwest, like, in Wisconsin and Illinois and, you know, the Rory, they're popping up on Iowa now, that forced the committee to reshuffle because if you're 500, if you seed out the tournament but going by seeds, oftentimes you'll have a trip that's over 500 miles, and that automatically triggers a flight for the NCAA. So the committee does everything it can to keep all of its matchups, especially in the first round, under 500 miles. So what happened was they had to, in the Midwest, they sent Aurora, you know, they try to keep those guys with the NCACs like Denison, whoever comes out of there, you know, you had Adrian, which is another Michigan school, they had to fit. So basically what happened was they made Cabrini, which was a one-loss team, their only loss was to Salisbury, they made them a seventh seed in the South just so they could sort of work the machinations so they kept everybody under 500 miles so they didn't have to trigger that flight, which is very expensive because they're sort of a cost-cutting measure for the NCAA. So that will always be the case. I don't think it's hindered, you know, Whittier getting in. It's just, you know, if Whittier gets in this year with a Pool B and so does Colorado College, you can pretty much put it in the bank that they'll probably be playing each other in the first round, although it's going to be 500 miles either way, so it may not even factor in that way. So they do everything they can, but actually I'll take that statement back because I think Colorado College and Whittier are 500 miles apart anyway. So the Western teams, they'll be traveling no matter what, and the chance of them getting a home game is almost non-existent, even with the schedules they have.
So regional teams facing a little bit of a conflict when it comes to seeding. Let's take a look at some teams that really don't have any troubles when it comes to seeding. I'm looking specifically at RIT, a team that was number one throughout the majority of the season, hadn't lost a game, would look primed to go to the championship and take it until they fell to Tufts. And it wasn't exactly close. I mean, Tufts came in there and they handled them pretty solidly. With RIT coming so close to the perfect season, I mean, they bring a lot of talent back. Do you see them kind of running the table the same way and finishing the job this year?
I think this is a watershed year for them because they need to prove it because their record has been almost spotless the last 2 years. And as you said, that 21-11 loss to, or whatever it was, to Tufts, I mean, that was a complete domination for a team that was dominating everybody else. So there's a question, you know, they lost Casey Jackson, who came in last year as a transfer, and then left. He's not coming back this year, but they have plenty of talent. I think they're a shoe-in, as you said, for the tournament. But they really, from my perspective, they have some questions to answer because they, at some point during the 2013 championship game, I mean, they were in control of that game. They had Stevenson beat and let that one go. And now last year, you know, running the table, being the consensus best team in the country, and then really getting handled by obviously a very good Tufts team. But yeah, I think this year with the talent they have, there are a lot of questions. And I know I talked to Jake, he's got a lot of talent coming in. Their expectations are still sky high. But it's sort of, you almost feel like they have to get over this last hump that's really given them some problems. So I'm sure they know about it. I'm sure it's on their mind. They probably don't talk about it. But yeah, I think this season with the talent they have coming back, yeah, they should be right there in the north. The question is, you know, can they stay that step ahead of the Cortlands of the world and things like that, and then have the ability to take a shot at Tufts and give them a run?
So on the other side of things, you have Tufts, who beat them in the semifinals and go on to win the championship. I mean, they return a lot of talent as well. Cole Bailey, all-star, all-world attackman for them, is coming back to bolster that offensive unit. They're sitting in most polls as preseason number one. But then you have other teams, like you said, the Cortlands of the world, the Salisburys of the world, Washington College, who has recently stepped up and made their way into the top 10. Do you see any kind of parity going on within the top teams here in the power conferences in Division III, or are we going to have a Tufts RIT championship in your projections?
In the north, Tufts RIT will certainly probably, that is the most likely event in the north. But the south is a little bit more wide open, because you have Salisbury, you have Stevenson, you have, I think Lynchburg is going to be very good this year. Washington College is going to be excellent. I've got Cabrini in there as well. I think the south seems more wide open than the north, because you say Tufts has, you know, almost everybody back. The defense may have to get restrung a little bit, but they're going to be outstanding. I really think the south is where sort of the question marks is. I think it'll be a lot more fun, because there is a lot more teams down there. Even a Washington Elite, I think, is going to be really good this year. The ODAC overall, then you've got the Denison and Ohio Wesleyan, who play in Ohio, but they're in the south region. Those two teams are going to be excellent again. So that's sort of the more wide open race. It'll be much harder to predict. The north, yeah, I mean, RIT and Tufts seem to be on a collision course. Cortland, they have to rebuild their defense. They're going to be, I think, a little bit behind, but Cortland, you know, always very good. Some of the NESCACs may threaten, like Amherst, something like that. But, you know, and Endicott's going to be very good as well. But, yeah, it's not – the North doesn't quite have the depth, or it doesn't appear to have the depth at this point that the South does heading into the season.
So, Jack, who are some of the players that we should watch out for as fans heading into the 2015 season? A big name that even came up on Friday night during the MLL draft was Callum Robinson, the defender from Stevenson. And those of you who had paid attention to the World Games had heard that name before. I mean, the guy is just an absolute monster. Ended up covering Paul Rabil for Team Australia and then was drafted to the pros. So he's a big name to watch in the field of Division III. Who else should we be looking out for?
Well, we have the returning award winners from last year, guys like Kyle Aquin from RIT, the midfield, Cole Bailey, as you mentioned before, at attack, and then Stefan Basile up at Union, who's the goalie. And I think of those three candidates to win it again, Basile looks like a pretty good lock for. You know, you've got Pat Johnson at RIT, who's been excellent for several years. Ryan McMahon is a four-year starter at Ohio Wesleyan, who I think Owu's going to have a great year, and I think he's going to be a guy who's going to get some postseason accolades. Caleb Abney at York is another goalie, big, huge guy. I think he's 6'6 or something like that. He's going to be a factor, because I think York's going to be very good. Bailey, you have to think if Tufts does what they did last year, he's our preseason player of the year. I think he's going to be the odds on to win it. But as you look at the attack unit from other teams or other teams, yeah, you've got Stephen Bannock from Stevenson, Josh Currier from Virginia Wesleyan, Ryan Lee, who was a freshman last year at RIT, ran with Casey Jackson, and Jack Kristen on the front line. He's going to be a big guy to look out for. Quinn Maroney, who led the nation in assists out of Amherst. I think he had 80 assists last year. Amherst is going to be better. He's going to be better. He'll be on a lot of top of a lot of lists. Aaron Murphy down at Lynchburg is another guy who had a big sophomore year, I think, coming back for his junior year. He could be ready to explode. Aquin will be interesting in term at RIT, whether he can repeat his midfielder of the year, because you know, he may have a different role. He was more of an assist guy last year as opposed to the year before that, when he was just mainly a catch-and-shoot guy. He'll be in the hunt. I think you have to look at John Upgren, who had 124 points last year for Tufts. He's a midfielder. Technically, he's kind of a hybrid role between a midfielder and an attack. But Matt Rakosi at Cortland, Damian Sobieski at Cabrini is a guy who I think will make some noise out of the midfield. A guy who really came on the stage last year at Endicott, a guy named Cotter, will be very good as well. So those are some guys in the midfield to look out for. But Aquin, Bailey, and Basile all coming back, you put them at the top of the list, but they'll get some challenges this year, especially a lot of those awards are driven by how well your team does as well. So if their team matches what they did last year, you can look for those guys again.
You're listening to Lacrosse Talk with Max Frater, Lacrosse Magazine's NCAA insider Jack Coyne joining us right now. Jack, I'd like to take a look at some of the newcomers coming into Division III. I know that we have spoken with you in the past about Coast Guard and the kind of impact that they're going to have on the league. Some of the other teams that are coming in as well, Carroll College, Ohio Northern, Delaware Valley, Cornell College, Muskingum, which is one of the funner names that I found while I was doing my research. It's so hard to be able to not know anything about a team and just kind of just by looking at their schedule see how they're doing. But we know it's so important for teams to get a hot start if they want to keep their recruiting going and be competitive as soon as possible. How do you see these guys starting out, some of them independent, some of them jumping into conferences? How do you see them faring in 2015?
Well, just a quick correction. Ohio Northern is going to come in 2016, so they're still a year away. And two other teams, Keystone, which will be going into the CSAC with Cabrini, and Wabash will be going into the NCAC. Those are two other new teams. When you look at how a new team is going to fare, you have to look at their conference first, and obviously the weaker the conference, the better chance they have of getting that sort of hot start, getting some name recognition, excuse me, and attracting recruits. Coast Guard will be going in the NUMAC. I think, Coast Guard was a established team in the MCLA Division II. I think they went to the tournament last year. I stopped covering that league, so I recall that's correct. So they also got a great start. They have a good school, and they can recruit. So I think they could step in and win a couple of games in the NUMAC. Obviously, Springfield is a top dog in the NUMAC. I don't think they're close to that level, even though Springfield's down a little bit. I think Carroll's going to struggle a little bit going into the CCIW. Out in Wisconsin, they got sort of a late start. They hired a late coach, so I'd be surprised if they can have too much. I don't think their schedule is very large either. So Delaware Valley is going into the MAC Commonwealth, I believe. MAC Freedom, excuse me. They that's not the strongest of conference. Eastern is the top team in that. They're going to win that league. But Delaware Valley, they could, maybe take a win or two, but again, it's tough to say because there's still some good teams there. Cornell College is heading into the CCI, or excuse me, the Midwest. I don't know. They got a good coach who's coming in from who used to be at Birmingham Southern, who should do a good job there. I don't know how many wins are in the future for them, but they should get a good start because they had a couple of years, and I think they had an MCLA team. It wasn't very good, but it had sort of a program base. Muskingum is going into the OAC. They're going to struggle just because the OAC is actually a pretty good league. Got some real competitive, athletic-driven schools, but they could catch up very quickly. Keystone, I think, will struggle because they've gone through some coaching issues. And then there's Wabash, who's got a great coach in Terry Corcoran. Excuse me, got a cold here. But that's a really tough league to hop into, and I think getting a win or two would be a pretty big accomplishment for them.
A lot of good coaching coming from these new programs, but at the end of the day, it's just whether or not they can put together a team that's ready to compete in the field of NCAA. Last question here before we let you go, Jack. With the new formation of the NCAA tournament, the at-large bids are crucial for teams who don't win their conference, especially for teams that aren't in a conference. You see a lot of these teams in Division I scrambling to make sure that they can find their way into a conference so they can get an automatic qualifying bid. Looking at the field of independents in Division III, which is huge, we spoke about Whittier a little bit earlier over in California. They've had a lot of success in the past. Is there anybody else in the field of independents that could be looking to grab an at-large bid that could compete with Whittier?
Whittier will be in the Pool B, so that'll be three bids. And they're in it with, their biggest competition is really Colorado College. I think you can pencil in Colorado College for one of those Pool Bs. Whittier's got a very good shot of the Pool B. And then the third of that Pool B, that's really up for grabs. It could be one of the CCIW schools like Carthage or Illinois Wesleyan maybe. I think Carthage, if you ask me right now, I would say they're a good bet for the third spot. But then there's a new conference called the Ohio River Lacrosse Conference, and teams in there like Transylvania or Hanover, if they can get the schedule or get the wins that they need, could be in the hunt. Augustana is another CCIW school. You know, Greensboro, they've got a new coach, but they're an independent that's always in the mix because they play a very difficult schedule. Their biggest problem, and it's also one that Whittier has flirted with in the past, you have to have be 500 or better to be eligible for the tournament. So you have to make sure that you play a strong enough schedule to be considered, but you also have to make sure you have the wins there and get to 500 or better to be eligible, because Greensboro has been a pretty decent team, but they play a brutal schedule, and they've had trouble getting to the 500 mark. They've been below it, and basically they've been out of it. Ferrum is another team that has been in that predicament before, played a very good schedule, but they just don't have enough wins. So there's a very interesting balancing act for a lot of Pool B teams. But right now, I would say Whittier's got a very good shot. I'd say Colorado College, I would call them a lock, and I think Carthage is sort of the team in that third spot right now, but they'll have a lot of competition.
There you have it, folks. So much to cover when it comes to NCAA, D2 and D3. We've got the man who knows it all here with us, Jack Coyne. And Jack, I appreciate you coming on the show with us today. I know we will have plenty more to talk about as the season starts to unfold here on the Crosstalk.
Sounds great. Thanks, Max. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jack.
That's Max earlier this week with Jack Coyne, our NCAA Division III insider. And we sure appreciate the efforts that Jack puts into this show. Without any further ado, let's talk a little bit of box lacrosse with our NLL insider, Brian Shanahan. Shanny, it's been a couple of weeks, and there's a lot of movement in the National Lacrosse League.
Well, there sure is. I guess when we last spoke a few weeks ago, Rochester, Edmonton, and Calgary, three of the teams everybody expected to be among the top, were 0-6, combined 0-6. But since then, there's been a turn of events for Rochester. They've won both their games. Edmonton has won both their games, and only Calgary has still yet to taste a win. But, Edmonton especially, I mean, they beat Calgary convincingly a week ago. They won 18-9 against New England this weekend. They look like they're back, and it's not a surprise that their coach, Derek Keenan, who took some time off, his wife was ill with cancer and unfortunately died about a month ago. So he missed the first few weeks of the season, and now he's back with his team, and they are a totally different team with him running the ship. And Edmonton looks like they're back on track. So you're going to see a big change in the power rankings this week, and you're going to see a couple of teams who are down low moving up pretty quick.
Shanny, what is it about Derek Keenan that makes such a difference to that Edmonton team?
Well, I think, to be fair, any time a head coach is temporarily away, it really makes it difficult for the assistant coaches. And, you know, subconsciously, I don't think the players know that, they're not really in charge. They know that they don't really have the authority, to strike down if things aren't going well. So I think it's really difficult to be in that situation as an assistant coach. We saw the same thing a few years ago when, the late Chris Hall was first missing some games with cancer treatments for Washington. They went from a, championship contender to out of the playoffs with, Artie Webster coaching. And it's not that Webster's not a good coach, but I think it's a real difficult situation knowing, there's the first thing is those guys are good coaches, Derek Keenan and Chris Hall. But when the assistant coaches, they're second, and they place that interim name on there, and I think it's a real difficult thing to do. But, having said that, Derek Keenan does carry a lot of confidence with him, and you can see that. They lost 9-8 earlier in the season to Buffalo, and Buffalo, a one-goal game. They got outscored 11-1 in the fourth quarter to Minnesota. I think that just wouldn't have happened with Derek Keenan on the bench. He's got a confidence, a belief, and good coaches make their team believe they're going to win. And I don't think those runs that hurt the men would have extended as long as they did with Derek Keenan behind the bench. So I do think he's a great coach, and I think you're going to see the Edmonton that we saw last year.
Brian, thanks for joining us on the show this morning. Let's take a look at the other side of the standings and your Toronto Rock sitting at 4-1. And something that we didn't really say very often last season was that the Rock held on for a win. They had a enormous trouble maintaining those leads and eventually falling in a couple of close games last year. But this year, they're hanging on and they're making the plays necessary to win down the stretch in those games, including last night.
Yeah, and I think the big thing is that they added Brandon Miller. He's an elite goalie. I'd say he's top three goalie, one of the top three goalies in the NLL. And he's making those big saves late in the game. And I'll give credit to Nick Rose. He did the same last week against Buffalo. But, a lot of things are going well for Toronto Rock. And, they added some big, strong guys on the back end, Brock Sorensen and, Brody Merrill and Jeff Gilbert. So they added some strength there. But when they lost their captain, Colin Doyle, and, with Garrett Billings out, a lot of people thought the offense would suffer. And it really hasn't. Guys like Rob Hellier has picked up his game, and I think they've become less predictable now, really, offensively. And they're getting balanced scoring from everybody on the offense. But the big difference so far has been their short man unit. They scored four shorthanded goals yesterday. So Calgary went 3-for-6 on their power play, but allowed four shorthanded goals. So Toronto was positive on that. Last week, Toronto scored two shorthanded goals against the Buffalo Bandits, and that was the difference. And last year, I don't think they scored six shorthanded goals the whole season. And this year, they've got about seven already. So, in a one-goal game like last night, you can easily just point to, the specialty teams, and that's the difference. And so things have been going well for Toronto. I know they let Calgary back into it, but, the veteran Josh Sanderson scored the winning goal with about a minute to go to give them the win. So, at the end of the game, it doesn't matter how it happened. It's who got the win.
Shanny, what was the difference from last week to this week with the Vancouver Stealth and their matchup against the Colorado Mammoths?
I hate to say it, but the obvious difference is that they took Lewis Ratcliffe out of the lineup. Lewis Ratcliffe, veteran, he's I think he's approaching 500 goals. He's got about close to 1,000 points, one of the best all-time in the NLL. But since Vancouver made that trade to get Johnny Paulus, it sort of looked obvious that Paulus just wasn't getting to touch the ball enough, wasn't getting the offense. With the style of play that Lewis Ratcliffe plays, it just didn't look like the ball was moving around enough. And obviously the Vancouver staff felt the same way because they decided to sit out Ratcliffe yesterday, a healthy scratch, and Paulus scored four goals, a couple of assists as well. And Paulus had struggled his first few games with Vancouver, but he only had one goal up to that point, and they didn't make that blockbuster trade for one goal in four games. So last night he had four goals, couple assists. Corey Small has been a good pickup. They picked him up for draft choices from Edmonton. He had a big night yesterday, but they seem to have found better chemistry now with Corey Small and Johnny Paulus from those left shooters, and that was a problem area for them. They've also got some great play out of the other guys. Dutch does what he always does, but Pat McCready had a good game yesterday, scoring a couple of goals, and he's been a big pickup as well. So I think they seem to find some chemistry. I think the more interesting thing is, what are they going to do going forward? Because Lewis Ratcliffe is still a very effective player, and although he seems like he's been in the league forever, he's only 33 years old, but I just don't think he helps the offensive chemistry on that team. So there might be a lot of other teams that would love to have a guy like Lewis Ratcliffe if Vancouver's not going to use him. But it was night and day between yesterday and last week between those two teams.
Brian, throughout the course of the season, with the way that the schedule pans out, we're going to see a lot of teams playing back-to-back games, starting off at home and then going on the road or vice versa. Buffalo took their turn at it this past week, picking up a win over Minnesota at home and then traveling to Rochester, where they fell 10-4 at the end of the first half. Do you feel like that those back-to-back games compiled with the travel kind of led to their slow start, forcing them to pick it up in the second half?
Well, it seems to be the logical thing that you would think that if a team is playing on consecutive nights and meeting a team that's rested, then they'd be at a huge disadvantage. But I think generally, if you look back over the years, the stats show that that's not really the case. I think more often than not, the team that has played the night before has done well on the second night. It's counterintuitive, but this year it hasn't been the case. Rochester's benefited 2 weeks in a row. Last night they played a tired Buffalo team, and the week before they played a tired Toronto Rock team, and Rochester has you know, won both those games. And it was kind of a strange game last night, Buffalo and Rochester. Buffalo built up that – or sorry, Rochester built up that 10-4 lead, and then Buffalo scored 8 goals in a row to take the lead. And then Buffalo scored 8 in a row, then Rochester scored 7 in a row to finish the game. So it was definitely a game of runs. But, yeah, you do see that a lot in the NLL. I don't think it's a huge disadvantage to the players, you know, 2 games in a row. They do that a lot. They play their whole career. These guys play junior lacrosse and senior lacrosse, and they've done that all the time. So back-to-back's not a big deal, especially when they get the week off. I think what's going to be more interesting is the back-to-back when the same 2 teams play each other both nights. I mean, and that, there's nothing more fair about that. And I think next week we're going to see that with Colorado, or not next week, 2 weeks from now, Colorado and Edmonton are going to play back-to-back, one in Colorado, one in Edmonton, and I think Toronto Rock's doing the same thing with Minnesota, and I'm really excited to see what happens, especially in that Colorado series, with Colorado off to a 3-1 start, and Edmonton looking like they're turning around. That might be Edmonton's chance to jump back in the first place where most of us thought they'd be at this time of the year.
Shanny, when I look at this schedule, I look at a schedule that makes little or no sense, quite frankly. I look at weeks like 2 weeks ago where there was 1 game, next week where there's 2 games, then about a month later there's only 2 games, and then we start to have some balance in what we're doing with the scheduling. At the end of the day, they play 18 weeks. Is this the National Lacrosse League's way of sticking it to Major League Lacrosse, or can they do something to shorten up this schedule and let these guys play in both leagues for a greater period of time?
I honestly don't even think the outdoor league, if it even occurs to them. I think they're, you know, they increase their schedule over the years. I remember, you know, this league started, it was an 8-game schedule, and even, you know, I think in the early 2000s it was about a 12-game schedule. So they've been increasing it year, you know, every few years. So it's up to 18 now, and I think it's just a matter of stretching it out a bit. I don't think there's any reason why the guys can't play every single week. I suspect it is more of a scheduling thing with NHL teams, NBA teams in the arena, rather than anything else. I don't think they're trying to stick it to the outdoor league. Maybe I'm naive. But I also think, you know, the outdoor league has not done themselves any favors by starting earlier and earlier every year. But, you know, for the most part, I don't, it's almost like those 2 leagues act as if the other ones don't exist. And, you know, until they ever come up with some kind of a partnership, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. I don't think they even care what the other league does. And I'd say probably now there's less of an overlap of players now than there was a while ago, and maybe that's a bad thing. You know, it's great that we get to see guys like John Grant play in both leagues, and, you know, a number of guys, but I think we're seeing fewer of the American field players playing in the box league now, and I don't know if it's because of the overlap makes it difficult or not, but I really don't think the NLL cares one way or another, you know, when the MLL starts.
With only 9 teams in the league, does it really have to be an 18-game schedule? Couldn't you play each team home and home and have a 16-week schedule?
Well, I think it's a good idea to increase the number of games. I like the 18-game schedule, and I could see it going to more. And I don't think they're building a schedule based on the number of teams in the league, because that can change, and it does fluctuate, and I could see that going up in the next few years. But I think also last year they increased it to 18 games. They increased the playoff format. And I think generally they felt it was a good success. So I don't see them going back anytime soon. You know, they did really well in the playoffs. They got good playoff revenue by increasing that. And so I think they feel that that's the direction they want to go. So I can't see it going back anytime soon.
You know, to keep on the theme of the MLL-NLL, because I kind of like where this is going, something that I saw last week during the lacrosse convention was the MLL draft. And myself and a lot of other people who were watching the draft were kind of wondering why certain players, mostly attackmen, were falling farther down in the draft than what their actual talent was worth. And then you come to think, well, these guys are also going to be playing in the NLL for the majority of the season, so they're going to miss the first four or five games of the Major League Lacrosse season. So, Brian, in your eyes, do you see a player who's playing in the NLL, drafted to Major League Lacrosse, do they have to make a choice saying, I want to commit to one or the other, or I have to put all of my effort towards one and not skip time on the other? How do you see that interaction with a player who has the chance to play in both leagues?
Well, I really do think there's a different mentality between the Canadians and the Americans, and probably because Canadians are brought up playing box lacrosse first, and you know, we've traditionally seen field lacrosse as you know, the other game we like. So I think most of them, if the gun is held to their head, if they have to choose one or the other, they're going to choose box lacrosse. That is the Canadians, but I think they all love to play both, so they'll get as much in as they can. I think I haven't seen the opposite, though, you know, when it comes to Americans who grew up only playing field lacrosse. Many of them can play box lacrosse. It is a transition to a game that they didn't grow up playing. But, you know, as we saw last year on the, you know, in the World Championships year, there was a lot of Americans that decided to take the season off from the NLL, from the box lacrosse. And I think it hurt them. There was not one player on Team Canada that won the World Championship that took the year off of box lacrosse. So I don't think that hurt them in any way. And you know, quite the contrary. I think it hurt, you know, the guys like Rabel and Siebold and all those guys, you know, Mundorf, who took the season off. You know, they're playing more lacrosse. I can't see how that can hurt, you know, when, other than the overlap, they're two different seasons.
Shanny, when we take a look next week at your polls, what are we going to see in the rankings?
Well, you're going to see the biggest movers are Rochester and Edmonton, you know, because, you know, a couple of weeks ago they were down at the bottom. And right now you've got, you know, the obvious Toronto Rock and Colorado have got the best records in the league at 4-1 and 3-1. And other than that, you've got a heap of teams that are playing 500 lacrosse, except I think you know, I'm of the opinion some are going in different directions. You know, I like Edmonton's 2-2 record much better than New England's 2-2 record. You know, New England's lost 2 in a row, Edmonton's 1-2 in a row. So there's a whole pile of teams with similar records, but I think you can, you know, put a team like Edmonton and Rochester up higher than some of the other ones. So you won't be surprised when you see a big movement from some of those traditional powerhouses up the power rankings.
Shanny, as always, we appreciate it. Even though it's a light schedule, we'll look forward to chatting with you next week. Be a bit later in the afternoon as we will be picking up live on the Laxworm Radio Experience, our new 24-hour, 7-day-a-week home for Lacrosse Talk.
Oh, that's excellent. I'm looking forward to it, Dan.
Thanks, Shanny.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay, thanks, Max. Take care, guys.
That's Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider, and make no bones about it, this one's recorded. It's Super Bowl Sunday, folks. But next week, we will be live every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern time on the Laxworm Radio Experience, our new home for Lacrosse Talk and a whole heap load of other stuff. There will be high school shows from throughout the country on the Laxworm Radio Experience. There will be at least 50 live play-by-play games on the Laxworm Radio Experience, many of them based here along the Front Range in the Rocky Mountain region. So many of you will get sick and tired of Max and I talk lacrosse and do our live games, but we feel it's imperative to provide as much live lacrosse as possible. We've got Air Force on that schedule three times. We've got Colorado. We've got Colorado State. We've got Colorado College. We've got Colorado State Pueblo and a handful of high school games as well. That's just to name a few. I know we've got 10 up in the tri-state area, Max, that will be coming to you with Laxworm, and we're still awaiting our schedule in the Maryland Mid-Atlantic area. So lots and lots of live coverage for the lacrosse fan to follow now, not just on streaming video, but streaming audio as well.
And you'll be able to hear us do what Dan and I are good at, is getting in front of the game. I mean, he and I can talk about the game back and forth for 2 hours, as you guys have heard throughout the past year. But, you know, being right in front of it and calling it as we see it, I'm really looking forward to that. I had an opportunity to do that a lot while I was at Mesa, calling the lacrosse games, calling it all the different athletic events they had going on there. But, I mean, obviously lacrosse was my favorite sport to call. It just comes so naturally, and it's fun too. I mean, I love just being at the games. So being able to provide the content for those of you who can't make it, you know, whether you're just you're a fan of the teams or you've got a kid playing on the teams, I want to make sure that you can hear these games, and we're giving you the best coverage, and that's what you're going to get with Laxroom Radio.
Max, we're still waiting for head coach Taylor Ray from St. Joseph's University to join us, and I don't know if we'll have him or not. I know he had some family obligations, but let's give him a few more minutes. And there's an issue that's come to light for me this week that is troubling. And that issue is it's going on at least club programs around the country, and that is players who quit because of a coaching change. And it just seems to me that there's no logic behind that process. You either love the game or you don't love the game. And just because your favorite coach leaves you to go do something else and a new coach comes in, it doesn't seem to me that you should quit. You're giving up on your teammates.
There are a couple things that come into play, especially at the collegiate level. If the coach that knows your playing style and recruited that playing style for his offense leaves, then you're looking at meeting with a new coach. And depending on the personality of the coach, whether he is very specifically offensive and defensive set minded, this is how I run my offense, these are how we run the plays, if you don't do it, get out. That's a tough personality to work with. And there are some coaches out there who are like that. So if you're a player that plays maybe a little bit more loose, maybe a little bit more freestyle, you like to see the way that things play out in a certain offensive set rather than running plays, specific plays, then you're not going to work well with that coach. So in some cases, I could see why a player would maybe transfer. Quitting, I wouldn't see. If you really loved the game and you wanted to dedicate your time and efforts for 4 years to it, I wouldn't see if you quit the game, then you didn't have the right priorities in the first place. I could see the reason why these guys would transfer. But you're right at the same time. If you love the game and you love the players around you, you find a way to adapt.
Is it different, Max, for a player playing club ball who's spending $3,000 or $4,000 a year to play to quit versus a kid who's playing D1, D2 lacrosse? And maybe he's not scholarshiped, but he's still playing the game at a different level. Is it easier to quit to justify it? That why should I spend the money?
For club, I would say so. Just because you're affiliated with the university, but you're not a sanctioned sport by the university. So you and your teammates and your coaches and boosters and parents are contributing to make sure that this program survives. When you're playing for an NCAA program, you're playing for that school. I mean, that record lives with the university for years and years and years to come. It's part of the established league, the collegiate association of the NCAA. The MCLA is its own formatted. It's different than the NCAA, at least in my eyes. Some people don't see it that way, but it still comes as a different style of play. So I guess when you're fronting that kind of money, for you to say, you know what, I don't see the value in this anymore because a different coach comes in, I think that might even be a little bit tougher. Just because your school is supporting you so much through the NCAA, through the MCLA, it's you. So, I mean, if you are really sitting down and thinking this isn't worth it, even though I've already paid the money for it, that's got to be tougher than leaving an NCAA program.
Right. I just look at it, and there are a couple of universities, at least at the club level, where there have been some coaching changes, and I know at those two institutions that kids are leaving for various reasons, not the least of which is they don't necessarily like their new head coach. And I just look at it, and my thought processes are, if you're going to leave before especially at the club level, leave before the season even starts, leave before fall ball starts, Don't even get started, because at the end of the day, you're really letting down your teammates to go at it for, call it fall ball, and then pull out during Christmas break because you just decided you don't like the coach, or you decided that maybe you weren't going to get as much playing time, or whatever it's going to be. And I see it as a huge letdown to the rest of a player's teammates.
And you're going to get guys who, you know, find out halfway through the season that they're not cut out for this, or they're not clicking with the teammates around them. So in every team, regardless of whether you have a coaching change or not, there's going to be players who are weeded out, you know, and that's how you really build the strength of your team, is you bring these guys in. Obviously they can play, or else you wouldn't have recruited them, but what kind of men are they? You know, are they guys who can face adversity? If a new coach comes in and you want to stick with this program, can you adapt? Can you make it work? If not, then you weren't right for this team. You weren't right for the game of lacrosse, and you learned that. So it's one of the things that college ball will teach you. You know, when you're a high school player and you're tearing it up on the field and you think that, you know, you're ready for any kind of competition that the NCAA can throw at you, then you get on the field, then you realize, holy crap, these guys are good. They're grown men. They are experts at their craft. I have a lot to work on. And then from there, it's a question of, am I willing to put the work in, regardless of the adversity, regardless of what my coach is telling me, to get better, to get that playing time. So I think you see with these kids who are leaving because of new coaching changes, it's they don't want to put the work in to change up their style of play or to fit into a new system. They feel like they play one way, it works for them, and if it doesn't work for this new coach, then I'm going to go find someone who does. So it just depends on if they want to stick around and build that program.
Yeah, absolutely. I get that end of it. And only time will tell for the institutions who are affected by the kids who have made choices to not play. The MCLA schedule got underway this week. The NCAA Division I schedule got underway this week with High Point and Delaware. Max, we're heading into lacrosse season full bore, and I couldn't be more excited.
But before we do that, Dan, let's get to the pressing point that all of us are worried about. And I had asked Terry earlier on in the show, Seahawks or Patriots?
I think that the Hawks are the better team. I think that their defense needs to get a couple of turnovers, like Terry said, early. And I think that I don't think New England's built to come back against Seattle. If Seattle can slow down Gronk, I don't think that Brady has enough faith in the rest of his wide receivers, sans maybe Edelman, to be successful. I also think that in order for New England to be successful, they've got to be able to run the ball, and that's not going to happen against this defense. I think Marshawn Lynch rushes for a buck and a half and three touchdowns against the Patriots today. Seahawks win this one 27-17.
And mind you, this is going to be played after the Super Bowl is already over. So we could either be football and lacrosse gurus, or we could look like idiots.
We could.
I'm going to play devil's advocate. I think it's tough because Seattle has the best defense, one of the better defenses the NFL has ever seen. But I think this year he cements himself, deflated footballs or not, as the greatest quarterback in NFL history. And the Patriots take this one. I'm going to say it's going to be a low score. Every Super Bowl the Pats have been in have been decided by 3 or 4 points. So let's say 24-21, New England.
If Seattle wins, and if Seattle holds New England to call it 17 points, does Seattle's defense go down as one of the best ever along the lines of the 85 Bears and so on and so forth?
Absolutely. I mean, looking at what they did to Manning, and I know that you don't want to think about it, but you get one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time in Peyton Manning on the biggest stage, and absolutely just, it wasn't even close.
No.
I mean, from the first play, it was not even close. So if Seattle can beat Peyton Manning and Tom Brady in consecutive Super Bowls, that has to be noted as one of the greatest accomplishments defensively for any NFL team ever.
This has been Lacrosse Talk on the Waxworm Radio Experience, our new home for 24-hour, 7-day-a-week lacrosse talk radio coverage come in the future, and we're looking forward to being a part of it. For Max Rader, and all of our guests today, Terry Foy, Jack Coyne, and Brian Shanahan. I'm Dan Matthews saying until next week, so long, everybody.